Bruce Shapiro, the sanest man in the United States of America, who is here to bring us up to date on Trump, war, and the prospects, however grim, for peace. Bruce, welcome back to the show.
It's always good to be here. There are people in my life who would undoubtedly disagree with your assessment of my mental state, but that's for another day.
Well, we are only talking about those Americans that we have experienced, Bruce. it's a smaller sample. Now, Bruce, short or long? The war, short or long? From 1 minute to the next, we don't know.
It's impossible to know, except... Well, it's impossible to know because there is no plan. There is no plan because this was always about not a coherent set of policy goals, but a spasm of violence and an assertion of domination by Donald Trump, right? There are two ways this could go. One way, the long way, the way Donald Trump describes it sort of in every other hour alternately, is to keep going until, what is the phrase, unconditional surrender by the Iranian regime. This is a problematic phrase, and it's problematic for two reasons. One is that, of course, as we are already seeing, the Iranian regime is not Venezuela. The Iranian government is deeply embedded in all aspects of Iranian society. It has still very large levels of popular support. It has still vast weapons caches all over the country. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard has enormous influence. It's a highly organized, multi-level structure. But the other kind of troubling thing, which I think there hasn't been enough attention to, is that the last time the phrase unconditional surrender was deployed in American politics, it was 1945. And it was deployed for the unconditional surrender of first Germany and then most importantly, Japan. You do have to wonder if in Donald Trump's brain somewhere the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima is somewhere in his spectrum of possibilities. We can't take this off the table, given how much violence there was. I don't think it's likely. The other option is actually to declare victory and withdraw pretty quickly. And the pressure on Donald Trump to do that is significant, which is why he said yesterday, well, I think it's going to end soon. We're almost done. Why? Because the political disaster coming for him and his allies is moving with increasing speed. Gasoline prices are up nearly 20% at the pump in just a week, at a time when affordability and rising food prices and all sorts of other things are already on voters' minds. It's happening in the very week that Republican members of Congress were gathered in Florida to hear from their commander-in-chief ahead of the midterms, hoping to push a very different message than the war. It's coming at a week when the first polls show public support for this war at the lowest ebb of any conflict since the history of modern polling.
What are the figures that you've seen?
Well, the Reuters Ipsos poll, which is a very well-regarded poll, shows public support for the war at 27%. That is very, very low. Even the Fox poll shows 50% support, and while all that is a lot more and is in line with the general division of American society over Trump, that is lower than the any other modern conflict at this phase. This is not a war that has popular support.
The invasion of Iraq had something like 92% backing, didn't it, in the U.S.? I mean, almost unanimous.
2001, it was the Afghanistan war had overwhelming. It was 92%, right? The first phase. The Iraq war, by the time it came along a year later, was a little less popular, but still pretty popular. It was 75-76%, I believe. And even the, you know, President Obama's ill-fated intervention in Libya had 47% support back in 2011.
But this is 27.
So, you know, there is nothing.
Yeah.
Right. There is nothing this low in the history of polling.
All right, Bruce.
And that is weighing tremendously on the White House as it goes forward.
Is the fact that the White House is worried about the electoral impact of this war reassuring evidence that there will be midterm elections? I mean, are you absolutely confident that he will hold midterm elections?
Well, you know, it's not up to the president to hold elections. We still do have a constitution, and it's important to remember that electoral law is governed by the states, not the presidency. It's not an executive branch function, right? This is not to say that this president could not cook up a national emergency that would interfere in some fashion. Much more likely is that you're going to see a national attempt to suppress voter turnout through, congressional passage of voter ID laws, through deployment of National Guard, supposedly to protect the integrity of voting. Like, you know, will there be attempts to interfere with voter turnout? I think that is the greater fear than cancellation of the election, right? I will say that the spectacular failure of this war to get public support, coming on top of the spectacular failure of the immigration enforcement operation in Minnesota and Chicago to get public support, and the string of every day now massive court losses in federal court for the various Trump administration policies should tell us that this administration's ability to kind of unilaterally shut elections down is closing, right? The ability, the maneuvering space for this administration is rapidly narrowing.
Trump is saying at the moment, is he not, that he will sign no legislation that comes from Congress until Congress first gives him to sign the bill that will almost end mail-in ballots, will demand ID at the ballot box, etc.
This is what he's essentially holding his own party hostage to this voter suppression strategy. It's a strategy that will almost certainly fail in Congress, not least because there are many Republicans who like mail-in ballots.
They've done well from them.
Where, for instance, there are a lot. They've done well from them. They're in districts where there are a lot of older residents who are more inclined to be conservative voters in all sorts of ways. Mail-in ballots actually help, right? So Trump's fantasy life and the false information that he has been pushing out, you know, ever since 2020 about stolen elections is beginning to collide with the reality, not just the facts of the country as a whole, but the political reality facing his own congressional allies.
But the war does seem to have helped him in this. Recently, sharp-eyed journalists discovered that notes of an interview with an accuser of Trump were missing from the papers released from the Epstein files by the Department of Justice. Now, those interviews have now been supplied and they have been published. My hunch is if they had been published 6 months ago, they would have been front page everywhere and perhaps, Bruce, I don't know whether you would agree with me, the most damaging allegations against Trump that have emerged from the Epstein papers, but they've barely been reported.
Well, first of all, full credit is due to the remarkable investigative journalist Julie Brown of the Miami Herald, who is the great Epstein Files reporter, who is the person whose eagle eye noted these missing records and who indeed has been tracking the story. And there's just, if you care about this, you follow Julie Brown, right? It is important to say, I think, that these are, it's not one interview, but four FBI interviews with someone who says that she was sexually assaulted by Trump as while being trafficked by Epstein in the 1980s. She's someone who is part of the pool of Epstein victims who settled with his estate. At the same time, it's important to say that the specific allegations of Trump, while credible enough, deemed credible enough by the FBI to support four interviews, have not been corroborated, and this particular Epstein survivor has chosen not to pursue it further. So you know, we don't know, and I do sometimes, when it comes to the Epstein files, bear in mind the words of one of my great mentors, a civil rights lawyer and writer named Frank Donner, who liked to remind me that the truth is bad enough. we already know, of course, that Trump has been found guilty of sexual violence in a New York state court. We know from Julie Brown's other reporting in the files, just in the last couple of weeks, that he had far more early guilty knowledge of Epstein's crimes than he has admitted. Whether this would have been somehow dispositive in the court of public opinion is hard to say. Trump already has survived, the kinds of massive public relations hits that would sink any other politician. It is the case, though, that the story of Trump and the Epstein files is not over. And as reporting goes on and as more documents go on, and perhaps as this or other survivors emerge with stories, it may yet come back to haunt him even further than it has.
But Bruce, this woman says that she was somewhere between 13 and 15 years old when she was trafficked to Trump by Epstein. Now, is it not the ordinary course of events that sexual assaults are rarely corroborated? They happen behind closed doors. This woman is considered credible enough, and she's done something which those of us who report these crimes are very, very familiar with. She's pulled out. She's had enough. She's not going on with it. This is a terrible allegation against Trump.
Yes, it is. And it's important not to minimize that, the sexual assault on a teenager. And it's quite specific in its detail. That said, again, you want to, one does want to be careful because,
of course,
corroboration isn't only about corroboration is not only about eyewitness testimony. As journalists like Julie Brown know very well, you can look for patterns of other information around a story. Was the place where people were? Were there other stories connected
of
to
course,
it that,
that all
you
know, of those,
make it look like a credible story?
All and, of those
and,
things
and all
must
of those.
Be.
Deserve to be aired, right? And I think the bombshell will be if this particular Epstein survivor, who is unquestionably someone who was trafficked by Epstein, the bombshell will be if she comes forward again or if other witnesses come forward to corroborate,
yes,
if not the most explicit details of the story, at least the general outlines. And then this will become a huge bombshell in the ongoing Trump-Epstein saga.
Regardless of warfare. Bruce, the sacking of Kristi Noem has been has shown us in Australia so much more about her that we didn't know. We thought she just ran ice, but she rides a horse beautifully. And, you know, she's... tell us about this, well, this the sad demise of this star member of Trump's cabinet.
Well, look, Kristi Noem, now former Homeland Security Secretary, pushed the boundaries of even Trumpian bad taste, you know, parading herself in a Rolex watch in front of a prison in El Salvador, in front of prisoners shackled. Okay, the $200 million advertising campaign featuring her on a horse in her full MAGA regalia, which, by the way, is what got her in trouble with Trump. She was not in trouble for the murders of Alex Preti and Renee Good by her officers.
She was not, it was the costumes.
Right, it well, it was... claiming that Trump had signed off on this $200 million advertising campaign, right? So she made the boss look bad. You can't do that in Trump world. And she becomes the first cabinet officer to be defenestrated in the in this next year of the Trump administration, right? I suspect she is not the last. There are others, including... including Attorney General Pam Bondi, whose handling of the Epstein files has similarly caused problems for the boss. What was quite interesting about Kristi Noem is that the signals were clearly sent to Republicans in Congress that it was open season. The other thing that did it, of course, was her affair with former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski on involving beds on Homeland Security planes, okay, on government planes. This even by Trump standards, did not go over well, particularly when she testified before Congress and refused to answer questions even from Republicans about this. And Republicans called out her murder of her own dog, and
the dog had it coming, Bruce. The dog had it coming. Didn't the dog have to be taught a lesson? I forget the details now.
Well, this was her. She trained hunting dogs, and she didn't like the way this one particular 14-month-old dog was behaving, and she shot it, according to her own account, which led Tom Tillis, Republican senator from North Carolina, to lead her on a very uncomfortable line of questioning, which he said, look, I'm a farmer, you're a farmer. You know that this dog was not at its age of maturity. You've shot a juvenile dog. Of course, Congress being upset about shooting a juvenile dog is fine, but not when juvenile human beings are being arrested and rounded up by the agency that she leads. So you have to find some disingenuousness there. But at the same time, it is actually an important lesson. The fall of Kristi Noem over the last month or so is an important lesson that there are outer limits of public outrage in the age of Trump, that the murders of Alex Preti and Renee Good and the brutality of the enforcement operations in Chicago and in Minneapolis did damage the president enough. And the levels of protest in those cities resonated enough with the American public that the White House felt inclined to retreat, not just from the policies, but from the people responsible for them. This is actually a consequential turning point.
And more, you think, to follow?
Indeed.
Well, we shall keep an eye on that. And Bruce, thank you once again for joining us on the show.